darkest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Welcome to episode 5 of Green Lantern's Light. This episode will be covering issues 181, 182, and 183 of the second volume of the Green Lantern series. My name is Jeffrey Taylor.
I am Michael Bradley.
I am also Jeffrey Taylor. No, I'm J. David Weider.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, wait, who am I again?
Who am I here?
All right. So, shall we jump right in, guys?
I think we shall. The first issue we're going to cover is Green Lantern number 181. It was released with a cover date of October 1984 and was released sometime around July 19th of that year for 75 cents and 32 pages. Our cover is by Dave Gibbons, and it shows Hal in front of the Guardians angrily throwing his ring down, and he says, "I'm tired of being your whipping boy. I quit." And our 17-page lead story is called Take This Job and Shove It.
Take this job and shove it.
I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason.
And I'm hoping you put that music in there.
Yeah, it's a song.
Yes, I understand.
Okay, good.
Just not by Janine C. Reilly, unfortunately. credits for this story are Len Wein, writer-editor, Dave Gibbons, penciler, John Costanza, letterer, and Anthony Tollin, colorist, warmly welcoming Mark Farmer as inker. And like a lot of issues we've covered to this point, we're dealing with a lot of plots and subplots here, so this issue jumps from scene to scene a lot, so please bear with me as I make it through this synopsis. We pick up what I imagine is not too long after the events of 180. As you might imagine, or as you might remember, after Ferris Air was attacked by the demolition team, and Hal wasn't around to stop him, Carol gave Hal an ultimatum, either the ring or her. Hal chose Carol, so as we pick up here, Hal soars through space on his way to Oa to tell the Guardians, and as he mulls over whether he made the right decision, he runs into a meteor storm before being confronted by a voice off-panel. We cut to Los Angeles, where at Ferris Air, Carol Ferris is talking to John Stewart about spearheading the effort to rebuild the airfield. In Washington, D.C., Jason Block roams the halls of the Capitol, lamenting the events of previous issues and thinking that time is short. He returns to his office and is confronted by a shadowed figure who tells him that he should have heeded Smith's warnings about his repeated attacks against Ferris. Block is defiant, and left with no other option, the shadowed figure reveals a set of claws. After a brief fight, Block, tattered and bloodied, staggers out of his office. He falls into a woman's arms and, with his dying breath, reveals to her about the papers in his safe and that Hal Jordan is Green Lantern. As Block dies, we find that the woman was none other than Major Diana Prince, who will, of course, keep Hal's secret. Back out in space, Hal is confronted by members of the Green Lantern Corps, including Aresia, Katmatui, Tomari, and Arcus Chumuk, who try to convince him not to quit. Things get heated, and Katma ends up punching Hal in the face, but Hal has made up his mind. He apologizes and flies off, hoping his former friends will be able to forgive him. Back in L.A., April visits Clay in the hospital. She tries to lift his spirits, but Clay is very depressed and pessimistic about recovering from his injuries, which, as you might remember, include a broken back.
Yeah, there was no Christopher Reeve Foundation for him to, and I mean this seriously, I'm not joking, for him to maybe take some experience and maybe some hope from.
Right. Meanwhile, Hal finally arrives on Oa and confronts the Guardians. Hal chews them out, saying he's done everything they've ever asked, and now it's time for him. He pulls off his ring and tells the Guardians to give it to someone else because he's no longer interested. Ceding to his demands, the Guardians strip Hal of his ring and costume, and after saying a final sad goodbye to his fellow Lanterns, Hal is teleported away. That evening, Carl Ferris talks to his brain trust about the status of the company. He tells John that Carol may have been premature in hiring him, since they may not have the money to pay him. But the good news is that if they can find the money to rebuild, they won't have to worry about the other problem, since Jason Block was murdered earlier that day. Just then, Mr. Smith enters the room, saying he represents certain parties anxious to help with solving Ferris's remaining financial issues. Back at Carol's apartment, Hal arrives, and after sharing a passionate kiss, they think about the future while Hal wonders if he really made the right decision.
Nice brief synopsis there. I really like that.
It was difficult to get it short. I will admit that much.
I usually have a difficult time, you know, sparsing it out, and that was a really good way to go about it.
What did you guys think of the cover?
I love this cover.
I really dig this cover, especially the fact that the Guardians are like, okay, Green Lantern's not happy, so we're going to hide behind this big yellow thing.
Well, yellow's a bold choice, and it really stands out. And then you have the diagonal flow of the body.
Right.
Kind of splitting up the page. And it doesn't bury the lead. It does what a cover should, which is give us a snapshot of the story in a way that makes you want to buy the issue. If I saw this on the spinner rack, I would pick it up.
And of course, we do have the two sides of the story. Here we have Hal quitting, saying, I'm tired of being your whipping boy. And then eventually we're going to get to John Stewart, who is – never mind.
Yeah. I just realized that could have gone somewhere awkward.
Well, I was trying to think of how to say it in a way that wouldn't come out awkward, and then I figured, you know what? I'm just going to leave it as awkward as it can possibly be.
Well, you know, on Green Lantern 87, the cover to that, John said he whipped Hal Jordan, so...
Payback.
I'm glad podcasting is an editable form.
I just like
white guys. I'll just edit that out?
No. No, I would definitely leave it in. I just really get a kick out of the fact that it's three white guys discussing it.
You might take out the awkward silence.
That's the best part.
Tell you what, I've got notes on, quite a few notes on this one, so I'll start us off. Starting with page one, I love this opening splash. I'm a big fan of when the Green Lantern Trail really looks, you know, has these interesting banks and turns. Mm-hmm. I don't even mind if it doesn't make sense, because sometimes I like style over substance. And I kind of
he was heading towards that planet, and he's like, "Oh, I got to turn.
I've got to bank and bank and bank for no real reason, and then kind of end up where I started." Really, there's a point A to point B where he could have.
Yes, and I'm actually wondering what that's supposed to be, because we see what I assume is Earth, and then the Moon, and then suddenly there's this. Is that War World or something? I don't.
it's a Panic in the Sky tie-in.
Okay. Really, really early.
Yeah.
But and there's another moon in the background. Okay, this clearly can't be Earth.
No, I don't think it is. I think he's come out of some sort of warp.
That's okay. No moon.
And then page two has this great sequence where he's flying through space and he sees Carol's face and it blends in with the scenery. It's amazing. But I know it's kind of symbolic of Hal seeing her everywhere, but I keep looking at it and asking, what is Elektra doing here?
I actually had a similar thought.
Yeah, because the topmost panel is actually, it's a planet, so it looks like a skull cap that she would wear. Nice. But no, I mean, the idea of the sequence is really marvelous, and I think only a handful of artists could have pulled this off, and Gibbons is definitely in that small handful.
It's kismet.
Yeah. And moving to page six, I am so glad to see Block go. That played itself out. he completely outlived his usefulness. And I think it's freaking hilarious that with his last word, he tries to tell the secret of Green Lantern, and the one person he tells it to is freaking Wonder Woman.
Yep.
That is awesome. And they don't make a big deal out of it. Just, you know, that's who he kind of blew that. As, and we've been saying all along, if you've got that information, why haven't you just used that to take out Green Lantern? And it turns out Block is just completely inept. And on page 7, when the Corps shows up, this is actually the second time in the books that we've been covering, as far as our run proper, that the Corps members actually show up. And two of these Lanterns will be extremely important to the books we'll be covering throughout the rest of this year and into early next year. That's just a spoiler. Not a spoiler, but a tease. Oh, and yeah, that's right. My main note here, Hal's being a complete tool. Like 100%, he deserves the punch Cat Matui gives him on page 8. And I'm really glad she calls him out on his crap, because he is being a hardcore hypocrite through and through.
I'm going to disagree with that, but I'll get into that in my notes.
Well, I went back and looked at Green Lantern number 30, and no, he's being a complete hypocrite. He was... There was a machine in that issue that told Cat Matui's emotional range between her loyalty to the Corps and her love for her fiancé, and Hal made her man up and stay with the Corps. And now Hal's saying, oh, I love Carol, I'm going to leave the Corps. Yeah, I know I told you that, but that's cool.
Well, how upset would she be if she knew the truth of what Hal did in that issue?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, the whole thing was staged from the beginning to fool Catman into staying with the Green Lantern. So
she was lied to completely.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And Hal was the one doing the lying.
And the Guardians are just like, oh well, you know, no one got hurt. Good job.
No skin knees. We're good.
I haven't read the issue yet, but from reading these three especially, I'd sort of mentioned this before we were recording, I really, really do want to go back through and take a look at basically all the Green Lantern books that led up to where we were going. I've read a few of them outside of the three that we covered, but it would be interesting to actually read through all of them in order and catch up to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I've been doing a little bit of that. I got the first two volumes of the Showcase Presents Green Lantern to kind of condense it and make it a little bit easier to absorb, because color seems to freak me out, and I don't know. No, it's just I like all that in one volume, and I can live without the color, even though sometimes that's kind of important to the plot.
I was going to say, in Green Lantern of all things, doesn't the color actually kind of matter just a little bit?
That villain may be yellow, but you do have the narrative there, because they always have to explain what's going on, so it's safe.
Well, also, they didn't trust their colorists often.
Really?
Every now and then, yeah. I heard some stories from a particular creator that I'm not allowed to talk about, or he asked me not to talk about, where he would send in things, and he finally got to the point where he would actually write in what colors he wanted everything to be.
Because they were just kind of running with it.
Yes, because there was a particular cover especially which just came out completely wrong.
Well, they did that back in the early issues of the X-Men. The Scarlet Witch was in green on the covers of two issues. It's in the name. Anyway, this is not an X-Men podcast. Getting back to what I was – to my page by page. On page 10, the scene between Clay and April, and – this one just really plays out like a bad Hallmark movie. Normally, this kind of emotional background character stuff is well-paced and well-written, not over the top. This is the exception.
Well, we get this here, but then in later issues, we get just a little taste of it to remind us that it's happening, and it doesn't even take this much time.
No, exactly. This is the exception to the rule. Normally, I'm good with some of the side characters. The dialogue here is just a little over the top.
Okay.
And on page 11, why did the Corps come back to repeat the scene again? Didn't we say what needed to be said a few pages back? It's kind of a repeat of the same scene.
Yeah.
I'll agree with that. But then again, I mean, you need the first one. The first one is far more important than this one. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of one of those moments like in Superman the movie where, like, well, I ran.
On page 12, the top panel with Hal throwing the doors open. Awesome.
Very awesome.
it actually sounds the gong for what is actually about to happen.
And it's very cowboy walking into the saloon as well.
Mm-hmm. And on page 13, the Guardians, they don't really play Hal's game. I don't think he was really expecting that. I think part of him hoped there would be some sort of compromise, some suggested somewhere, maybe part-time Green Lantern, but nope. Okay, that's how you want it. There you go. Bye-bye.
I didn't get that from it at all. I thought he was just saying, no, I don't want this. And the Guardians are like, so this is your final decision.
Well, true. I mean, I think they're kind of, after Howell's flip-flopping the last few issues, they're just like, look, I don't want to deal with this guy anymore. You're in or you're out. Figure it out.
Well, I mean, the Guardian says to him, and what would you have us do with your power ring? And he says, frankly, I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's – I think that this is very much him quitting. I mean, this is very much take this job and shove it.
Maybe. Maybe I'm reading more into his
– Your decision is final then? Carved in granite.
True. Maybe I'm reading more into it than what I – yeah. Way to take me down, Jeffrey.
That's what we're here for.
Sorry. Yeah.
And to kind of wrap this up, at the last page, some people would marvel at the beauty of the view that they have there. I would ask, what is wrong with the sky? That's not right, people.
Yeah, they went a little overboard with the stars and planets. And yeah.
But no, this was a good issue. Maybe I was rereading. Of what?
Of all the adventures that Hal has had in space and will never have again.
Of course not.
For about a year and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are my notes on that issue.
Okay. First off, the very beginning, you were talking about how he's, you know, zipping around and everything. It actually reminds me a lot of the opening to issue 172, which was the first one that we talked about in our regular coverage starting in episode 2.
Definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's flying back to Earth for the first time in a year, and here he is flying to Oa for potentially the last time, from what looks like Earth, but really can't be. But then again, it could also be symbolic, just like the ending. Who knows? On pages 1 and 2, it still occurs to me that he's going to make this. If he's going to make this big of a decision, he probably should have thought of it like a year ago. Because he spent a year in exile before this.
Yeah. And then he comes back saying, yeah.
Yeah. He was so committed to being a Green Lantern and a member of the Corps that he allowed the Guardians to exile him so that he could keep his job as a Green Lantern. And left Carol Ferris, came back thinking that she might be with somebody else, having completely just let him go because she had no idea that he'd be coming back. And now he's deciding, I've had enough of this. And honestly, if he was going to come to this decision, he probably should have done that a year ago. But oh well. On page 3 in the last panel here, this is actually a sentiment that's shared on the cover of the next issue.
You're right.
No, not you. Although it's not related in any way whatsoever. Now, something interesting, when I'm reading these things and my wife is sitting next to me, my wife has an MDiv, and she's very, very close to becoming a minister. So when there's a Bible reference, like what John Stewart says about, you know, lady, I could have rebuilt Jericho after Joshua was done with it, I had to ask her about it, and she was able to tell me, not only does that come from, in the Bible, Joshua chapter 6, verses 15 through 21, it's also a spiritual from slave times.
Right.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Something that John Stewart, as a student of many things, including history, especially his own history, being an African American, his ancestors probably were slaves, that he would have looked into and known about. So I just find that to be really, really interesting. I don't know if that's what was intended with that statement, but it's been turned into pop music as well. Page five. At the first read, I have no idea who this guy is, and in fact, we're not going to see him again in the next two issues. So I still don't know exactly who this person is. So don't tell me, and
page
we'll...
five?
Yeah. The guy who's killing Jason Block.
That's...
Okay, that answers one question I had in my notes, whether it was supposed to be... Whether they were intentionally trying to obscure the identity, or...
It's probably one of those things where if you really pay close attention and you've read a lot of Green Lantern books, you can probably tell who it is.
Well, if you think back two issues.
Okay.
That's what I took it as.
Right. Who was the
villain? Maybe I'm just forgetting because that was a while ago. So Green Lantern 181? No, Green Lantern 179?
Yeah, right. I completely...
Who showed
up? Oh, the Predator.
Oh, that's the Predator?
That's who I took it to
that's
be.
That's lame.
I'm just maybe I'm incorrect, but that's who I took it to be.
No, that probably is who it is. But they don't show his face or say who it is. So I was like, "Oh, who is that? It can't be the Monitor. I wonder who that is." So yeah, you're probably right. That probably is the Predator. It looks a
Mr.
lot
Burns.
Like him. Okay.
Excellent. Excellent.
Mitt Romney, you're making us all look bad. So then you get to page six. Well then, I wasn't expecting him to suddenly die like that. It to me, I mean, this totally goes against what David was talking about, but it sort of felt like his story was getting ready to go somewhere because it hadn't really gone anywhere yet.
Right.
And it's interesting that he's ready to out Hal Jordan, because by the time somebody tries to confirm it, Green Lantern's going to be a completely different person.
That would have been great.
So, I mean, it didn't even have to be Diana Prince necessarily. They could have gone with something else where he'd said, "Oh, yeah, I have information in the safe that proves that it's Hal Jordan." And that person actually goes to the safe, gets the proof, and you can get a whole storyline out of that about how somebody's trying to prove that he's Green Lantern. And he's like, "No, I'm not. Duh." Page seven, the only Green Lantern guy that I do not know the name of is the Jiminy Cricket guy.
Yeah, I didn't know him either. That's why I just skipped him in my synopsis.
I'm sure that if I dug out my Secret Files and Origins of the Green Lantern Corps that lists like every single Green Lantern that's ever appeared in any book, I could probably find him, but I just don't know, and I have not dug that out. But page eight, when Cat Matui punches him, I do still feel like it's an unnecessary assault. It's to show a little action,
yeah.
And yeah, I get that, but it's still... They're fellow core members, and they're just, you know, duking it out because they're pissed off. And I don't like it when people do that. I don't like it when my comic book characters do that, my comic book heroes. But we've gone off about that before, so moving on. On page 10, April should contact Diana Prince and get a hold of that purple healing ray for Clay. I was saying, it's another one of those things where, you know, when the hero is unable to go help and save the day, this is the DC Universe, another hero could show up and help out, but that only happens when it's a team-up issue, so what are you going to do? On page 11, since Aresia is so young, I can see why she sees this as Hal doing something to the Green Lantern Corps and to her and to these characters, but the rest of them... You know, they might have their own reasons, too, to be really upset with Hal for quitting. But it really should be Hal's decision. I mean, it's one of those things. When you retire, which is essentially what he's doing, he's retiring from the Green Lantern Corps. He's quitting, but he's also retiring. That these people, they can react however it is that it's normal for them to react. I'm just saying that it's a little bit unreasonable.
Yeah, although they do seem to kind of come around towards the end of the episode, or the end of the issue, a little bit. At least come to a place where they're like, well, maybe we can understand it at some point.
Yeah, and Arisia's like how old now? Like 7 or 8?
I thought she was slightly older than that, but
slightly.
Not by too much.
Maybe, okay.
Yeah.
Because her species ages differently, which is why Hal has to think of her as a sister, because otherwise he'd be hitting that. On page 12, I would say that this entire page sums up the reason why I'm so interested in this version of Green Lantern from the mid-1980s. Because of what Hal says, you know, when you said jump, I jumped, which is one of those things from Silver Age where when the Guardians asked him to do anything, he did it because he was a superhero, and the DC superheroes just did what they did because it was the right thing to do. There was never anything else behind it, like reasons why they shouldn't, or wanting to have their own personal lives. No, those things, they may have mattered in a particular moment, but they'd never really mattered overall, and here they'd matter overall. And he says, because I believed you did know what was best for the universe, but now I'm only concerned with what's best for me. And that's a very human thing that you wouldn't see a lot of necessarily in the Silver Age.
No.
And maybe a little bit in the Bronze Age, which this is still technically part of the Bronze Age, at least until Crisis. That's how I see it. Different people see that different ways. There's no definitive moment, like how Showcase number 4 is the definitive beginning of the Silver Age.
Mm-hmm.
Page 14... I thought it would actually be kind of funny. This is on pages 13 and 14. I thought it would be slightly amusing if the Guardians took the ring back and then said, now find your own way home. Page 15. Smith, it's just so funny to think of things in terms of the Matrix, which I recognize came out years and years later. But this guy is Agent Smith. He's got the sunglasses on. Yeah. He's wearing a suit. The only thing he's missing is the earpiece.
Give him time.
Yeah. We still don't know that much about him, and I am curious to see where that's going to go. And we're still not going to learn that much about him in these three issues that we're talking about either. But on page 17, this is the ending where he and Carol share that moment, and it's the end of him being a Green Lantern. I just thought it would have been hilarious if Hal came home and said, you know, I gave up being a Green Lantern to be with you, and so that's how serious I'm being. If Carol was just like, yeah, about that, Hal, we need to talk. But that's it for me. Michael?
You guys hit a lot of my points. Like David, I really liked his opening splash. I think Gibbons has had a lot of great splashes in almost every issue we've looked at so far. And I'm going to miss him when he's gone. Not to say I won't enjoy the next artist, but I think Staton's going to bring an entirely different aesthetic to the title. And whether that's better or worse, I'm going to miss what Gibbons has been doing. Pages 2 and 3, this does start out a lot like issue 172, and I can't help but think that was very much intentional on Ween's part, because, you know, in 172 he hits that meteor storm and he just deftly handles it with a billiard cue construct, where here he's so distracted by everything that he just runs right into the meteor storm and doesn't even know it's there. And then he meets the same group of lanterns that he did. You know, skipping ahead to page 7 and 8, he meets the same group of lanterns that he did in 172. So I can't help but think that was some very intentional symmetry by Ween.
Yeah, I believe that this was meant to be reflective.
Yeah.
Although, was Jiminy Cricket in there too? I don't remember off the top of my head.
No, I don't think he was there then.
Okay.
Though he might have been. There was an entire group of lanterns in 172, but Arisia and Count Matui and Arcus did most of the talking
right
there. I'd have to go back and look. But page 4, John introduces himself the same way, pretty much the same way that he did in issue 87, which I'm not sure if that was an intentional throwback or not, but I found it kind of funny. Page 6, a bunch of people here block you know, they hear him screaming and see him coming out of his office all cut up and beat up and bloodied and then die. Shouldn't someone have maybe checked the office or called the authorities or something? I mean, maybe they did. Logic would dictate that the culprit is still in the office. So I just don't understand why everyone just stands around. And maybe they did check it, but and it only found an empty office, but it's not shown or even mentioned. So
shouldn't Wonder Woman do her spinny thing and go in there
exactly,
and check it out?
Exactly. But that
but
actually,
he just came out all cut up and dying. It's scary in there.
She's Wonder Woman.
And Steve Trevor's like a soldier.
But I did like the cameo by Wonder Woman to do away with the subplot.
I really love that. I started laughing hysterically. My wife is watching some TV show on her little computer, and I'm reading this. Suddenly, I just start cracking up.
But on the other hand, I don't understand why Wayne introduced the subplot at all of Block knowing Hal's identity if he was just going to write it out 2 issues later. It makes no sense.
I'm completely with you on that.
And I mean, at some point, someone is going to clean out Block's safe and you know, probably a staffer or whoever has the office next. So I guess we technically still have that loose end of the file still being out there. But on the other hand, maybe Wonder Woman broke in and stole the file later, making it no longer a problem.
I was going to say, maybe she just went in and, you know, ripped the safe out.
Yeah, but that's never shown. So it's just a huge hole that doesn't make any sense, and why it was introduced in the first place, I don't understand. My next note that you guys haven't already covered is... Well, let's go to page 12 for a minute. So do you guys agree with Hal's choice here of quitting the Corps?
No.
Or do you think he's being hypocritical?
I think that he's doing this to be with Carol, which is a decision that he chose not to make a year ago. And he's making it now because he could have – well, here's the thing. If he were not Green Lantern, he would not have been called away when the demolition team showed up and destroyed Ferris Aircraft. However, if he weren't a Green Lantern, he wouldn't have been able to do that much to begin with.
Exactly.
However, on top of that, if he weren't Green Lantern, the demolition team would never have been sent there.
Yeah, because they were going to destroy Ferris, not Green Lantern.
Oh, I thought they were being sent. I thought that Block sent them there because Green Lantern would be there.
No, he sent them there as part of his vendetta against Ferris.
Okay, well, this is one of those problems with a monthly podcast, then.
David,
no, I think, yeah. I mean, I agree with Jeffrey. It should have been made a year ago, and now he's. We saw him do the great big speech, and I'm a Green Lantern through and through, and now he's like, nah, I quit. The first sign of any trouble within his relationship. What if Superman did that? Oh, Lois is a little upset. Better quit.
Well, I think that's one of those differences between Carol and Lois, because Lois would never ask Clark to quit being Superman.
Right.
Because that's a huge part of who he is, and if the world is in danger and he can do something about it, he's going to do something about it. He has to, and she is going to continue to worry about him. But in Carol's case, you know, Carol for a long time, as far as my memory serves of reading the other books, she actually was very much like Lois. But then of course she became Star Sapphire, and they really did do some stuff to differentiate her. And I suppose that is something that she would ask, especially in that sort of a situation where her company is gonna go bankrupt. I mean, they're done, they're over, unless they can get things rebuilt. And even then, there's no way to necessarily do it. And Hal did say that. He said, I'll be right back as Green Lantern to help you out. And the next thing you see is him rocketing out into space. I mean, what the heck? From her point of view, what the heck?
Right.
And I don't think it's justified, because he did a very good thing going and helping to save that entire planet. But from her point of view, come on.
Did it ditch us in our time of need?
Exactly.
But at the same time, he did what he needed to do. And he served the greater good, so to speak, by saving the planet opposed to some damage at an airfield.
I know. If anything, he should be quitting in a nicer way. He should be saying, like, look, guys, here's the deal. I really love this woman, and she's presented me with this ultimatum because, you know, I really should have been there, but I had to go and help the Green Lantern Corps, which was really important. So I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything, but I think I need to move on and live the rest of my life. Where instead he does everything but moon them.
That was a cutscene. They didn't have
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That panel was cut off from the waist up.
Page 15. No one really has much of a reaction that Block was in fact murdered. I mean, I know Mr. Smith comes in right after that, but there's just really no reaction at all. Davis just blows it off by saying, well, that's one problem down, one to go.
Like he's doing a grocery shopping list.
Right, exactly. Yeah, or a laundry list. But so I thought that was kind of weird. But that's all I had as far as notes go. I thought overall it was a really good issue. A lot of parallels to 172, which I think was intentional, and probably the strongest of the three issues we're going to cover this episode.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I completely missed the parallels, and I feel completely ignorant now because they are, if you're looking for them, they're there. They're quite, not obvious, but quite clear.
It's easy enough to miss.
So this issue has a 6-page backup story entitled One Night in a Bar on Laurel Hardy 11. And it was reprinted in the Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Volume 2 trade paperback.
It's really funny because, I just been sitting laughing at the Diana Prince thing and had to try and explain that to my wife, who did get it because she knows Wonder Woman at least that far. And then I just said, they're on a planet called Laurel Hardy 11. And she starts laughing too. It's like, yeah, and the Green Lantern in this one, his name is Chip, spelled CH'P. She's like, oh, that's funny too. And he's got a brother named Dale, and she starts cracking up.
But credits for this story are Paul Kupperberg, writer, Don Newton, artist, John Clark, letterer, Anthony Tollin, colorist, and Lynn Wein, editor. This story takes place, well, one night in a bar on Laurel Hardy 11. Laurel Hardy 11 is a planetoid, a most wretched hive of scum and villainy. Two patrons, Gronk and Twiffle Toot Toot, trade war stories when they notice a small, furry critter clad in a red robe enter the bar. Twiffle worries about the newcomer's safety, but Gronk, seeing the look in the critter's eyes, promises he isn't one to be messed with. A wager is placed between the two, and the newcomer soon confronts a group of rough-looking space pirates. The thugs blow him off, literally backhanding him across the bar. But the critter climbs back to his feet and launches himself across the bar, attacking the thugs with a savage ferocity. In the ruckus, the stranger's robe is torn off, revealing Chip of the Green Lantern Corps. Chip demands the bar's patrons clear out, except the space pirates he's there to arrest. He reveals that the day before, the space pirates had attacked a luxury liner. While Chip disabled the pirate ship, they made a getaway in an escape pod, knocking Chip out in the process and leaving thousands of passengers in the luxury ship dead. As Chip then proceeds to clean house with the thugs, Gronk tells Twiffle to pay up. He pays the money, but only under protest, saying the fight was rigged. And Gronk replies, "Only reason I won is 'cause I know what they didn't. These youngins gotta learn, you just don't mess with no mean-eyed furballs."
I had very little notes other than I had a really meta note saying we're all going to have a note on this is obviously the Star Wars cantina.
Right.
I had a very similar note. Yeah, this is a huge Star Wars reference in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, if you look, I mean, it looks the art actually looks like Marvel Star Wars when they were publishing the book.
Oh, interesting.
Did Don Newton not do art for some of that?
I don't know for sure. I will find out. But my only real note was kind of overall that this could have been a really light laugh riot, but Chip quickly makes it awesome because he's a very much as stoic an action hero as Hal or any other Green Lantern. And yes, I mean, it is kind of a chuckle, but Chip really lays it down.
And on top of that, he shows up dressed like Ben Kenobi.
Yes. But overall, I mean, it was just, I really enjoyed this as a one-off, straightforward, you know, just action story, mini action story.
Yeah, my notes are also very sparse. First off, I really love the art. This is not necessarily an artist that I'd want to see on certain kinds of stories, like, say, a Superman story that's very street level or something to that effect. But the aliens are drawn really well. The cantina, quote unquote, is drawn really well, too. There is a tiny bit of a physics problem, which is that this place would not have gravity, let alone air, that they can just keep the door open. But that, well, I suppose that's one place that's encased in something, so that's fine. But it would not have gravity. And my only other note, it's a really amusing story. It does have a very weird and abrupt ending, though.
Kind of, yeah. It does just come right up to it, and then I'm done.
I definitely thought there would be another page until I noticed that it said the end at the bottom, and then suddenly I'm on letters.
Yeah, it's really more of a story about Gronk and Twiffle than it is Chip. And that's really right. the focus of the story.
Don Newton did not do Star Wars.
Okay. I was mistaken.
I started to think so too, but that's not the case.
Anything from Michael?
Oh, just that it was a fun story. Not quite sure what it has to do with Green Lantern so much, but I really like this.
It's a tale of the Green Lantern Corps.
Well, yes, but as I was getting ready to say, not every story has to be strictly what you would expect with a Green Lantern story. I mean, that's right. One of the good things about these backups is that sometimes you can tell irregular stories, and sometimes it works, like with this one, and other times it doesn't, like with the ones we had last episode.
And like the ones we're going to be talking about in a few minutes.
Okay. I didn't think the other ones were quite that bad, but maybe when we get into it, I'll hear what
let's
you
see if I can
it.
Change your opinion on that.
Okay.
Okay.
But like you guys, I thought the art was great. I don't think Don Newton gets enough recognition for his work, and he didn't do many Green Lantern stories, so we may not be covering any more of his work on this show, but I'm glad we got this one.
Gotcha.
Oh, I was going to talk about the letters column real quick. The letters column has responses to issue 178, and Howard Alpin writes in asking all sorts of questions about the monitor, and Len Wein replies, "We'll do our best to answer what we can here. The questions regarding the monitor proper will all be answered in a 12-issue maxi series currently called DC Universe: Crisis on Infinite Earths." To begin in January 1985 and continuing throughout this 50th anniversary year.
And I think you mean 1985.
Is that not what I said?
You said 95.
Okay. 1985, okay. Right. And then he goes on and lists 5 or 6 upcoming appearances of the monitor throughout the DC universe. I don't know why I'm so fascinated with this constant evolution of the crisis as they document it in the letter columns, but it's kind of interesting.
Well, because at that time, it's almost like we could say what we want about Crisis and what it did for the DC universe and the industry, but we're coming also from a point looking back. Looking here, they had no idea what was about to come.
Right.
And in some cases, you could tell they were developing it kind of on the fly in some cases, making it up when they, well, you know, composing at the typewriter, so to speak.
I really do kind of wish that I could have asked more questions about it when I interviewed Marv Wolfman, but it was not the time nor the place. Because we were talking about 12 issues of The Adventures of Superman.
Right. On From Crisis to Crisis, right.
Correct. Yeah. I want to say that was episode 15, if anybody wants to track that down.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, he was going through a rough time during that era.
Of the books, you mean, or of the...
In his personal life.
You mean in 1985, or when you...
No, in 1987.
Oh, when he was writing Superman. Okay.
Right. Okay.
But the letter column also says that Mark Farmer is coming on as the new inker for the foreseeable future, but he only inks the 3 issues we're covering this episode, and then I think Gibbons inks a story again, and then we get another inker for a couple issues before Gibbons stops penciling entirely, so... Not really sure what happened there.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to look too far ahead. Like I've taken a look at the next three covers, but not any farther than that. So I'm not positive about all the things that are coming up, but I'm really loving Dave Gibbons' art, and I feel like he's really gotten a handle on Green Lantern at this point. Yes. Not that he didn't before, but I felt like this issue really just was nailed.
Right. Yeah, I really have liked his work, like I said earlier, and I'm going to miss him when he's gone, even if I like the next artist, Joe Staten.
I'll have to decide when we get there.
All right, well, do you have any more comments, David or Jeffrey?
No, I'm good.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back for issue 182.
Said Mongo, didn't he? That's wrong character, wrong universe, and wrong galaxy. Hold on just one sec. Ah, here we go. Flash Legacies, a podcast connecting the adventures of Wally West, the third hero to be known as The Flash. Join me, Dave Walker, in my bi-weekly journey as I look at Wally's career from when he first donned the mantle of the Flash all the way up to the return of Barry Allen. Find me at flashlegacies.libsyn.com.
We're back, taking a look at Green Lantern number 182, which came out on November. Well, no, it did not come out in November. The cover date was November 1984. It came out August 16th in 1984 as well. The title is It's a Dirty Job, but the credits for this one, if I can take a look on page one, Len Wein as the writer and editor, Dave Gibbons penciler, Mark Farmer inker, John Costanza, letterer, and Anthony Tallon, colorist. So, getting into the story, Hal Jordan drives a Ferris Jeep through not to be confused with Iron Jeep. Okay, a Ferris aircraft Jeep through the Sierra Madre Mountains, where he hikes and rock climbs to a peak where he visits the grave of Abin Sur, his Green Lantern predecessor. We're treated to an origin story recap for Green Lantern, where Hal was brought to Abin Sur just as he was dying and was given the ring for the first time. So Hal talks to the grave about how his membership in the Corps was thrust on him, and now that he's given it up, he can go on with his dream of being with Carol. His hope is that Abin Sur would understand and forgive him for this decision. On Oa, those crazy guardians voyeuristically watch Hal and finally realizes that he was serious when he said he wanted to quit. And so it's time to pass the ring on to his successor. In L.A., Carol Ferris and April O'Rourke, having finished their lunch, exit the Brown Derby restaurant. Carol has hoped that getting out would help April's depression, but she's still upset that her fiancé, Carl Kendall, is in the hospital with a broken back. As they walk to their car, a man dressed as a public flasher with a trench coat and fedora bumps into April and keeps walking without apologizing. You'd think they were in New York City. She calls him an idiot, But he thinks to himself, idiot, am I? Ah, oh, my dear ladies, if only you knew. You have brushed up against greatness this day, but your narrow minds could not recognize the truth. But soon the world will know me. Soon the world will bow before me, or suffer the catastrophic consequences. I spent my time in prison well, refining my powers, strengthening it, devising a personal force field that makes me unbeatable. Now, as never before, all the angry elements of nature are at my command. Ha ha ha! The command of the new, improved Major Disaster, who I'm not a big fan of personally, but that's just me.
But he has pink boots, Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah.
Pink,
and
pink thigh-high boots.
They are crotch-high boots. So... At Ferris Aircraft, Davis approaches John Stewart, their new architect overseeing the repairs, to ask when the runway will be ready so they can get moving on work with their solar jet, which is sort of their paycheck project. Then Mr. Ferris and Mr. Smith approach, and Smith is nothing but nice to everyone, even offering John Stewart anything he might need to help with the repairs. But none of them like Smith at all. They find him creepy. Just east of L.A. at the Baldwin Dam, Major Disaster shows up and scares away guards, threatening to destroy the dam. Back at Ferris, Carol runs into Dr. Bruce Gordon, who is upset because he received a note that reads, "Surrender the solar jet, Gordon. All power under the sun is mine." Carol wonders if it's from Congressman Block, but Gordon points out that it's unlikely because he was murdered last week. Gordon can only hope that it's some morbid practical joke, but he doesn't notice as he walks by a window that the visage of Eclipso smiles back at him. At the dam, Tawny Young reports the situation with Major Disaster. She explains that his demands that if Green Lantern doesn't show his face in 1 hour, he'll blow the dam. The military threatens to open fire, but a disastrous fissure opens up under their feet, burying them alive. At the hospital, Clay is still recovering from his broken back and turns off the TV, hoping, and he doesn't tell April that he hopes that the dam blows because then he'll be put out of his misery. Hal returns to Ferris Aircraft, where he runs into Tom, who clearly has some sand in his vagina. He pitches a fit like a 2-year-old and storms off before John Stewart comes around the corner and tells them they should go off and get a drink. And by drink, they mean ginger ale with a lime twist. Stewart mentions that Hal looks really familiar, but he can't quite figure out where he knows him from. Hal knows, of course, that this must be because, as Green Lantern, his mask doesn't actually hide that much. They overhear Tawny's report on the TV calling out for Green Lantern, and Hal has to think fast since he's not Green Lantern anymore. Stewart excuses himself, and Hal goes to use the payphone, explaining to the roughneck talking up his sweetheart that it's an emergency. But he was there first, and he has no manners or sense of being in public. He goes out back to use the other phone outside, where he witnesses John Stewart reciting the oath and powering his Green Lantern ring in full costume before flying off. Hal is shocked that the Guardian gave him the ring, although I don't know why he's so shocked about it. Stewart arrives at the dam and meets Tawny Young. All the reporters are surprised since he's not the Green Lantern they were familiar with, although with the mask on, I'm at a loss to know how they could tell the difference. John walks out to the dam and introduces himself to Major Disaster, who is royally pissed off at this joke. He says, either you bring me the real Green Lantern now, or he's going to destroy the dam and thus the city below. To be continued. So who wants to go first?
Not everybody all at once. Go ahead, Michael.
I don't really have too many notes about this. I'm not really a fan of this cover. I mean, I know what they're going for. It's kind of a For Your Eyes Only riff, I guess. But it just doesn't work at all with the costume and the character, with a costume that's mostly all black. Page 2. Am I the only one who got a Star Trek 5 vibe from this? No?
Page 2?
Page 2.
I did not.
Hal Jordan climbing a mountain.
Oh, because it's there. Because
it's there, yeah.
But Abin Sur is there. He has another reason.
Yeah. Anyway, page 3, I love the design on this page, and I liked seeing the origin recap with Gibbons doing some homages to the panels from Showcase 22. It's kind of weird, though, that we get more information on Hal's origin here than John's, which kind of leads to my biggest problem that I had with the issue that I'll actually get to in a minute. At the same time, though, it's still going to very much be Hal's book, even though he's not Green Lantern anymore. My next note is all the way over on page 12. I'm a little confused about when Carol introduced Hal and John. I mean, it's only been a few days since the last issue, so I guess it could have happened off-panel, but I'm not sure why she would need to introduce them, since it was Hal that recommended to Carol that she call him, which would indicate that they knew each other already.
She would assume that, but he doesn't indicate. I don't. He obviously. Well, he may have clarified to Carol how he knew him. But Carrie, keeping the secret, she would say, "Oh, well, let's introduce you to make it quote unquote official on the books."
Hal may have said, "Hey, Carol, meet John. He's my black friend."
Awkward silence is awkward.
Everybody needs a black friend. Just saying. Well, white people do anyway. You can edit that out. It's okay.
If I can skip past the gigantic Flash Force promo here, we'll get to page 15. I'm really disappointed that this is the big reveal that John is the new Green Lantern. I was expecting a scene with, you know, the Guardians and them selecting him and all that. And I think we needed something more than this, because as it is, we feel like we lost. It feels like we lost pages. Am I the only one who?
No, well, I kept flipping back and forth. Like, did I miss the part where the Guardians come to John and say, "Okay, it's your time"?
Yeah,
I got the sense that was to go along with the surprise that John Stewart is the new Green Lantern, even though it shouldn't be that big of a surprise if you have been reading the book for a long time. But we're talking about over 100 issues here, really. So, I mean, has he, since I haven't read that much between when he first appeared and this time, has he been in the books, like, at all?
He made a few appearances.
Okay. So it shouldn't be that big of a surprise. He's meant to be the successor.
Right.
So, and the fact
he was that he was the reserve.
Right. And so, well, yeah, the reserve and then consequently the successor.
Right.
So what's kind of interesting about that is that, you know, if you have been reading along, you might expect that it would be him, especially since he's shown up in the story at this point. But I think that it's just for the surprise value. And then I think we're going to get something. It's not like I don't know if it's an origin story or a story of how the Guardians approached him. But that's coming up. We'll talk about that in an episode or two.
Next episode, right.
Right, okay.
I guess what I'm saying is I think we just needed a splash page or something flashier than what we got here. With basically all we have is a kind of a three-quarter page pose of John standing rather awkwardly with the ring on. And that's just not very flashy.
Well, I kind of like the idea that Hal then goes outside because he needs to find a phone, and he sees John Stewart, and that's the big surprise, and we get to be surprised at the same time. Like, that's where the cover pays off.
Okay. Page 17, I haven't pointed them out because at a certain point it gets to be kind of rather petty, but there are a lot of coloring errors in this issue, and this page highlights it, given that on this page alone, John's gloves are three different colors, including at one point yellow.
Yeah, it doesn't stop with this issue either.
Right, yeah. But that's all I had. It just, I don't know, I kind of thought it was a disappointing issue. We needed something more for John's debut, and like Jeffrey said, we do get an origin story a couple issues down the road, but so this one didn't have to be an origin per se, but I just think his debut needed a little more pop.
A little oomph.
Yeah. What do you got, David?
Well, starting with page 2, I don't like that Hal refers to Abensur as an old friend. He didn't really know Abensur for more than a couple of minutes, and I kind of accept that he kind of has that connection because he did inherit Abin's ring, but they're not really friends. And that kind of continues into page 3, where, oh great, we get the origin again. Because we've covered, I mean, it's been a part of three separate books that we've covered on this show. And, two. On page 4, Hal says Abin put so much faith in him, and I kind of hear Abin Sur's voice, like a ghostly voice, saying, "It was the ring, not me. Blame the ring." And, you know, I'm glad you guys laughed at Major Disaster, too. He reminds me of Captain O from the Olympic sales ad. It's like he just flung a costume together with crap that was in his shed outside.
Yeah,
I've seen cosplayers put more effort into their costumes.
Really, and the same design worked pretty well when he first appeared in Green Lantern number 43. But it's just the way it's drawn; he looks so frumpy. And on page 10, I don't know how this happens, but I tend to have a habit of covering books that involve the color green and a lot of multiple personalities. Just saying.
Yeah.
And I also like on page 11 where Tawny's like, "Green Lantern, we need you." Well, what about Superman, Flash, Aquaman, Wonder Woman, Ambush Bug, anybody?
I had a similar note, like, you know, wouldn't this be a good time to get on the phone and call the Justice League?
Yeah. And my final note is on page 14. Hey, Eddie Brock makes a cameo as the guy, you know, as the roughneck on the phone.
That's your final note? Page 14?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't feel so bad then. I expected you to have more to say.
Not on this one, no. Okay. I was kind of surprised myself, but I didn't know if we were going to talk a little bit about Green Lantern 43, which is mentioned.
What was Green Lantern? I didn't look that one
up. Oh, no. That's actually in the next issue. Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
Oh, that's Major Disaster's first appearance.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't go back and read that
and
one.
Not his last.
Nope.
Unfortunately. Okay, I really actually dig this cover.
Oh.
It's not exactly something that happens in the story, at least not in that way, where you see Carol and her father and it looks like the entire cast is on there somewhere or another. But it made me want to read the book.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, yeah, you want to know who it is. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And I already had to read the book, but if I saw that on the newsstand, I would have picked that up, as well as the previous one. So reading this book, once again, this is really where I was reminded how much I enjoy the ongoing narrative of these kinds of comics. And I feel as though in some ways that's been missing from the few issues that we'd already read, mainly because the same kind of material is already there, but it's done better here, I thought. But getting into the meat of the story, page one. Oh, hey, I live near the Sierras. I can see them from my house. That's kind of funny. On page three, you know, sometimes you need to have the recap to the origin. And this was actually one of the better places to have it than we've actually seen so far.
Well, true, there is kind of a natural segue, but did we really need the origin for the umpteenth time?
Not for the umpteenth time, and I'm not saying that they need to do it as often as they do it, but if they're going to do it, here's a good time to actually go about it.
I'll agree with that point.
Right, and moving on to page five.
I think part of what distorts our perception, too, is we covered Showcase 22 and then Green Lantern 1 in that first episode.
We didn't really cover Showcase 22. We kind of went straight into Green Lantern 1.
But it encompassed Showcase 22.
Right.
That's where my perception was a little bit off, because I thought we'd covered it too.
But I don't know how long it had been since they recapped the origin in the actual book. Because we haven't, in our actual coverage, we haven't had an origin recap, have we?
No, but also in the Len Wein era, did sales go up? I don't know if that's actually
I don't know anything about sales from this era.
Okay, yeah, I really don't either. But once Len Wein took over, I would have to imagine that sales must have gone up, and maybe some people were being introduced to Green Lantern for the first time. So maybe it felt necessary to throw it in once in a while. But as I was saying, this is one of the more organic places to actually have it. Because he is having that conversation with the grave of Abin Sur.
Right.
Right. On page five, of course, the successor, or at least the reserve, and therefore the successor, was already chosen a long time ago. And I think it's funny that the Guardians made it so clear that once Hal gave up the ring that he'd never be able to get it back. Here they're hoping that he'll still change his mind. Like, oh, I guess he's really serious about this. because he wasn't that serious about it before.
I'm reading the page again.
I believe the word carved in granite probably should have been.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it's odd because that's kind of the inverse of what we talked about with the last issue.
Pretty much. And it's time to have the successor, when in fact that should have been one of the first things on the Guardians' minds. But I mean, the page is still necessary, don't get me wrong, especially because of the story that we're getting into now. But the whole thing about how, oh well, I guess his heart isn't really in it, when he made that very clear earlier, is just a little bit weird.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah, on page 6, at first I actually thought that this was the guy who killed Block, because I did not recognize that it was the Javelin, or it, is Predator. That who it was? The Predator. That's yeah. What I said. All supervillains look the same to me. Call me racist, but. Moving on to page 8, the thing is that Smith hasn't given any actual reason for people to hate him. All he's done is show up and say, hey, I'll bankroll Ferris Aircraft getting back on its feet. And so nobody really has a valid reason to dislike him, except that he seems a little bit weird or off. And Carol's father, whose first name I'm blanking on, Carl. Okay, I was going to say Carl before. Carl really doesn't like him. He even says, I still don't like having you around here, Smith, but since your people are bankrolling Ferris's recovery, I guess I don't have much of a choice. Smith has given no reason. I mean, I honestly think that Carl should really like this guy, and maybe other people will think, well, he seems a little bit weird. And especially, I can totally forgive Jon Stewart not liking him, because since he is a sort of new hero, that he can see through somebody who we know is not on the up and up. Because we know that Smith is into something, but nobody else should know that. So it just felt a little bit strange that nobody trusts this guy.
Yeah, John's comment on this page felt a little off to me when he says, the only difference between him and Pondscum is Pondscum has more class.
Right, that, but yeah.
That just felt off to me, because he has no reason to – I mean, not having a – not trusting the guy is one thing, but – that just seemed a little
okay. Off. Well, I'm just thinking that if anybody's going to see through Smith, it should be Jon Stewart.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
But that I don't think anybody else should be that upset about this guy, especially Carl Ferris, whose company is being saved by him.
Right.
So it just felt weird that nobody likes this guy. Jon Stewart's the one guy who I would say, yeah, if you don't like him, then that makes sense, because you are the burgeoning hero, and if anybody's going to see through him, it really should be you. On page 10, Eclipso! Nice! I really like that, and the fact that, you know, Bruce Gordon has been the villain Eclipso in the past in Green Lantern, and he's been a regular character here. You knew that Eclipso was going to show up at one point or another, and this is the first real hint that we get.
Right.
And so clearly Eclipso is the one who sent this note. So Bruce Gordon sent himself the note, basically. It would be almost too bad if he didn't say, but it looks like my handwriting. I don't understand. Why do I write in all capitals? But on page 12, let me go back to page 11. I'm sorry. This is always the way. The hero gives up being the hero and then gets called out by the villain. I mean, it happened in Superman 2. Later on, it happened in Spider-Man 2, where he stops being Spider-Man, and then Dr. Octopus kidnaps Mary Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of the standard, and I'm not faulting it for that. I'm saying this is always the way, and it's like that for a reason, because it makes for a good story.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Page 12, Tom is in a mood. And since I got started reading Green Lantern right around the time that Kyle Rayner became the current Green Lantern, I like jokes about looking for women in and around refrigerators. Page 13, yeah. page 13, my only note about this is that the waitress looks like Harbinger.
A little bit.
I'm pretty sure that it's not.
No.
I can't imagine that she's moonlighting as a waitress on top of being the monitor's little helper person. But even so. Getting past the whatever that middle story is, that's just a pain in the butt.
I have to keep paging through it to get to the next part of the story, yeah.
Yeah, it did occur to me to give like a brief recap in the middle of my recap of the story, but I didn't even want to take the time to read it.
And then there are people in matchbox cars racing for something that I didn't really understand because I didn't read it. But
exactly. But moving on past that to page 14. Here's where I have that note. Actually, wouldn't this have been a good time to call the Justice League? Like, hey, why don't you guys send the Flash? Or someone? Anyone? In fact, if it was the Flash, that would be great because it goes back to the story where it was Major Disaster's first time in the comics. Could be, because didn't he actually switch their powers or something?
Yes. I think that's recapped in the next issue.
Okay.
Briefly.
Gotcha. We will get into that pretty soon then. Page 15. Again, why is it a surprise to Hal that it's Jon Stewart? Like, he seems really upset. Like, you know, they gave that lousy ring. They gave the lousy ring to Stewart.
And why is he upset about it?
I don't know. Maybe he expected they would go to a different planet. There are plenty of other inhabited planets in space sector, according to the continuity. So, but it went to Jon Stewart, which really does make perfect sense. I don't see why Hal is that surprised or even upset.
Right. He shouldn't be surprised at all. Jon wasn't Hal's backup on Earth. He was his backup for the sector. So,
right.
Yeah.
But of course, it's got to be somebody on Earth, or else it would be just weird.
Well, Sector 2814 is more than just Earth.
I know, exactly. Okay. That's what I'm saying. But from a storytelling standpoint, it should be somebody else from Earth.
Right.
Yeah, because we have to have it grounded in the superhero universe as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And then my final note for the last page of this story on page 17, where Major Disaster is threatening to break the dam, I think to myself, wow, it's a good thing that Jon Stewart is an architect.
That could come in handy next issue.
It could indeed.
Yes, which we will talk about in a few minutes. But first we have to go to take a look at the backup. This is part one of something called Eye Lantern, which is taking the name, of course, from iRobot, the Isaac Asimov story, because it's about a species of robots, which the Green Lantern character, Stell, comes from, who is a robot. Again, it's an entire race of artificial intelligence where they do reproduce, basically. So the basics of this story, because I don't want to get hugely into it. I'm actually not a big fan of this story. We have the entire race that Stell comes from. They're called Grendons, which I almost called Grenadines. the main character of the story is named Wyron or Wyrn. I'm going to say Wyrn because it's like iron with a Y. And his girl robot, Elga. And there are these bad guys called the Krydos. So on the planet Grenda, I'm thinking that it's called, there are these race of robots. They revere the character Stell because he was of their race and he was a Green Lantern. And they are attacked by an alien race called the Krydos, which are very much clearly, they're saying that, you know, you are unnatural creations. So it's basically like attacking the gays, I guess, or some race that they don't like because they don't find them natural. And in this case, they are artificially intelligent robots. So they attack with these things. They're not even really bombs. They're these little spheres that are work like bullets to be aimed at the robots, take them out and destroy them. And Wyron is very, very upset by this for obvious reasons. Now, the new Green Lantern of the sector that got Stell's ring shows up, and he starts to try and take out all of these Krydosians. I don't think that they're called that, but I'm going to call them that. And what Wyron does is just grab this Green Lantern, who doesn't have a name. He's some sort of a bug creature. He's got six arms and six legs. And a weird-looking orange face. and he demands that this Green Lantern take him to Oa right now in the middle of the battle. And so he's taken to Oa, where he meets up with the Guardians, and he demands to have Stell's ring because he's the one who deserves it, and he pitches a little fit over it. And so the Guardians, for no apparent reason, say, okay, we'll give you a ring. Go and do your thing. We'll see how it works out. And he goes and he tries to take out the Kraidoshians back on his planet and stop them from basically killing all the other artificially intelligent robots. But in the process, he uses some sort of a jamming device that he constructs with his ring, which actually hurt a lot of the robots at the same time, including his girl Elga. And he's really upset that he's actually the one who killed not only her, but a whole bunch of other robots. Not all of them. It almost looks like he's killing all of them, but we will find out in the next issue that there are still plenty that are still alive elsewhere on the planet. So he has essentially failed. Yeah, sorry to kill that for you. You now have slightly less to talk about in this story that doesn't make that much sense.
Not really, no.
No, I mean, I'll talk about my notes last. You guys go ahead first.
Michael, why don't you take the lead on that?
Well, I really don't have too many comments on just this part, so I was going to save all my comments until we do part two, if that's all
right
with you guys.
Yeah, I didn't have that many comments across either one of them. It was a head scratcher because, as Jeffrey said, it doesn't make a lot of sense. well, yeah, I'll get into that in part two as well.
My only notes about this, because it is specific to this story. Number one, it seems a little weird that this guy wanted to go all the way to Oa while his planet is under attack now and there is a Green Lantern there. So that's very selfish of him. But then again, his whole point is being selfish. So I can kind of forgive it on that level, but it still doesn't make sense. And on the fourth page, these are the weirdest, oldest looking interpretations of the Guardians I've ever seen.
They look withered.
Right. And I really do not buy them even temporarily letting this be a lantern.
Well, they said, let's see what they say. He says, make me a lantern. And then he starts tearing up the hall of Oa or wherever they're at. And they say, your irreverence is unamusing, but due to the dire circumstances of your people, we'll attribute it to your distress. Yet, we sympathize with the emergency on your planet. If your induction into the core will alleviate it, then in all good conscience, we must grant your request.
Basically,
right.
That'll shut you up.
Yeah, I still don't buy it, because even under duress, a lantern needs to be able to exert self-control.
Okay, I'll buy it.
And so here he is destroying this hall that he's in, and that's what makes them say, okay, we'll give you a ring, even just temporarily. No, I don't buy that, because I think if anything, they would say at that point, no, you clearly don't have the ability to control yourself, and so being a lantern is not fitting for you. That's why you weren't chosen. Now, I mean, this is all going to come to a head in the next issue, which will kind of bring it to the point where it makes sense, but it's still on what I would consider to be a flawed premise.
Yeah, I'll actually grant you that. I'll agree completely.
Okay.
I mean, I can see where we're going to call you on your crap, but at the same time, endangering lives to do that is irresponsible.
Exactly. I mean, I'm all about him going back and messing everything up and killing people when he does not mean to kill them, and having that be part of what he has to atone for. But the actual getting of the ring is what kind of kills the whole story for me, because when you build the story around a flawed premise, I can't get away from the flawed premise.
Well, the whole thing is, he could have just had the ring at the onset of the story and been that Green Lantern, and it still would have worked fine in the outcome.
Yeah, he could have had the ring been the one who was chosen, and had the Guardians maybe had some reservations, like, we're not sure about this guy. The same way that they had reservations about Hal Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Fair enough. There's no letters page in this issue. Instead, we get a non-colored preview of the artwork to the cover of Green Lantern number 183, which, after a promo, we will discuss.
Do you enjoy time travel in general and the Silver Age of comic books in particular? If so, join me each week on the Superman Fan Podcast. My name is Billy Hogan, and I will be your host. Together, we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. 1 week, we will take a look at the Superman family of titles, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, World's Finest Comics, and soon, Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane. The next week, we will feature the Man of Steel's titles, Superman and Action Comics, which will include the Supergirl stories during her run in the back of that title. You can join me each week on Wednesday or Thursday at the supermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com, which is available on iTunes. And your emails are always welcome at supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape.
And we are back with Green Lantern number 183, and I have the synopsis on this one. This one, by logic, was cover dated December 1984, would have been on stands around September 20th of that same year. It was written by Len Wein, penciled by Dave Gibbons, inked by Mark Farmer, lettered by John Costanza, with colors by Anthony Tolan, who must have some color blind issues. The cover actually shows a figure, well, John Stewart in the costume, shoving Hal Jordan out of the way, saying, "Out of the way, Has-Been, I'm the Green Lantern from now on." And it picks up right where we left off with John Stewart and Major Disaster standing on the dam, and Disaster demands that the real Green Lantern, not this imposter, shows up. John tries to strike Major Disaster, but his shields hold, and John is himself struck by lightning that Disaster pulls down from the sky. Confused, Major Disaster tells John to give him some space, get back with the rest of the crowd so he can sort this situation out. And Major Disaster's confusion stems from the fact, going back through a flashback, that he actually knows who Green Lantern is, because he found Hal Jordan's journals many, many moons ago as a thief named Paul Booker, which is actually what led him to become Major Disaster in the first place. Hal had placed a mental block on Major Disaster with his ring so he could never speak the name of his real name.
AKA the greatest way to get rid of a villain ever.
Yep. Infinite Crisis. Or not Infinite Crisis, Identity Crisis.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually.
I remember everybody was shocked, like, that's a new concept. I'm like, no. Superheroes can be shady. So now, this is obviously a surprise because we have a decidedly different Green Lantern. So while waiting for Disaster to kind of work it out, John flirts with Tawny Young, promising to explain how he became Green Lantern a little bit later. And back at Ferris Aircraft, Thomas explains the reason he's been upset is that Hal consulted the Flash, Superman, everybody but him when making the decision to quit being Green Lantern, and he's supposed to be Hal's best friend. Hal tries to apologize, but Thomas just stays mad and storms off. Back at the dam, Major Disaster proposes a compromise. Major Disaster asks John to bring him the former Green Lantern so that he can have his revenge, and we'll call it even. We're cool. But when Major Disaster still can't say Hal's name, John actually seems like he's mocking, so Major Disaster throws a fit, gets angry, and destroys the dam. Back at Ferris Aircraft, Bruce Gordon gets a call from a mysterious stranger in that, you know, stripper outfit or flasher outfit that Jeffrey mentioned. Still claiming to be to claim the Solar Jet, and
yeah, but that's not Major Disaster.
That's not, no. What did I say?
Well, no, it's not the same guy in the Flasher outfit.
Oh,
it's a different guy in a similar Flasher outfit.
There's a lot of those.
Yeah.
So he gets a call from a mysterious stranger claiming the Solar Jet to be theirs. As Mr. Smith watches the call, and Mr. Smith smells something suspicious, so he's putting some plans in place to protect that. Meanwhile, John manages to save everyone by creating green water chute constructs to channel the water safely. And once everybody's safe, the lieutenant informs John that they have scoured the area for a body, but Major Disaster appears to be alive. Back at the hospital, April manages to pull Clay Kendall from his self-pity party as he prepares to go home and adjust to his new situation. And elsewhere, dejected, Major Disaster walks down a city street, kind of trashing things left and right in his little dejected area.
If anything, those are minor disasters.
Exactly. And suddenly he realizes everyone around him seems to be wearing a Green Lantern uniform. So Disaster is starting to really freak out when John gets the drop on him and punches the villain out. So basically it turns out John used his ring to play this little Mission Impossible mind game, and it worked because Major Disaster is taken into custody as John walks off with Tawny. Meanwhile, at Carol's house, Carol tells Hal that apparently the Guardians chose his successor well. But Hal wonders to himself why he feels like a dagger has been stabbed into his back. And we lead this issue with Hal suddenly asking, what have I done?
All right, so I think I'm going first on this one. I've already mentioned I'm not a huge fan of Major Disaster, which is why I have pretty much nothing to say about the first three pages. So moving on to page four, I love this idea of Tawny Young with John Stewart. I don't think it's going to happen where they're actually going to get together, but I don't know for sure, so I don't want to jump the gun on that. But again, how can people tell the difference? They wear masks.
Exactly.
It could be the same guy. But anyway, page five. Tom is mad that Green Lantern Hal Jordan didn't ask him before quitting the Corps. So that's why he's got sand in his vagina. That makes sense. Whatever. Get over yourself. He's throwing a temper tantrum like a two-year-old, and he needs to just get over it. I don't understand why he's so upset that Hal went and asked Superman and The Flash and Green Arrow, who are his superhero friends, instead of asking Tom, who is not a superhero.
I had a similar note.
The decision had nothing to do with Tom, and he couldn't have given Hal any useful advice because he doesn't have the same... He couldn't understand this, what Hal was dealing with the dual identity, like Superman and the other heroes could. So
and yes, he's the closest thing to a Green Lantern sidekick that you're gonna find. I mean, unless you were to think of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, but neither of them were a sidekick. They were very much a team. But Tom is just I don't understand. I mean, maybe this is just like his very, you know, human side that he's upset about it, but he's going too far with it. I mean, if anything, he should have just talked to him instead of pitching a fit.
Yeah, it makes sense that he would get his feelings hurt a little bit, but it's very selfish that he would get this upset about it. And it really kind of feels forced too, a little bit, from a writing standpoint. Like they're trying to inject some drama into the story that just doesn't belong.
Exactly. My only note about page seven is the dam breaks. This can't be good. Taking a look at page nine, because I really don't have a lot to say about the Bruce Gordon conversation that Smith sort of overhears part of, that I love how this is described with John Stewart. What he does is he sets up a second dam that will then catch the water, but it's too much and it actually cracks the dam, and he experiences some psychic feedback and loses concentration and then gets caught in the water as it comes into the dam that he's just made the construct of. It's a really interesting way to look at how the Green Lantern ring works, and I totally dig on that.
Yeah.
Really neat idea on the next page, page 10, with the viaduct, because it's showing that John Stewart is getting the hang of it. Like, he's got to do it, and he's learning it in the School of Hard Knocks, essentially. And it's a very good idea. So he is beginning to get the hang of it. We move on to page 12, where we have the scene with April and... what's his name? And Clay. Now, technically, it's only been a week or two since Clay broke his back. So recovery is actually coming along pretty well. And from what April says here, where she's like, you know, you need to have courage like a hero, the heroes you were trying to create, the hero that you were trying to be, you need to have that courage. And I'm going to be here with you no matter what. April's a keeper.
Yes, she is.
Yes.
She nails it on the head.
And do not mess with an Irish redhead. Just saying. moving on to page 13, the next page. This is such a weird page with all these disasters. I mean, until you get to the end, it's just like, what the heck is going on? There are all sorts of disasters. Like, you know, the guy falling from his ladder and a paint bucket falling at the same time. Trash can catches on fire. And of course, you even see like Acme truck. You're expecting it to explode. A safe fault, a fire hydrant just sort of explodes water because he's major disaster. And yes, these are technically minor disasters, but he just walks by and these things happen because that's kind of his superpower. It's almost like Black Cat with the bad luck.
So was John causing these disasters?
No, I think Major Disaster was.
Okay, because the safe on page 13 is green.
That's true, but
that could have been a coloring issue.
Because I guess that's a coloring issue.
The fire hydrant is also partly green and partly gray.
I think it's just Major Disaster walking by and having these, well, technically minor disasters happen because that's sort of his superpower. But it is a very weird page, especially when you get to the Granny Green Lantern and you're like, what the heck is going on? And then on the next page, he's seeing everyone as a Green Lantern. And I'm thinking to myself, what? You just had a comic book convention.
It's just cosplay. Learn to back it off.
And
I like the guy carrying the very 80s boombox.
That's going to be my new Facebook profile picture.
Nice. Excellent. Now, one minor quibble about page 15. Major Disaster says Hal Jordan's name out loud. He's not supposed to be able to do that. That's kind of the point.
Right. I didn't even catch that.
It's on the second panel. Is it the second panel? Yes.
Yeah.
He says, first, Hal Jordan is Green Lantern. And then that black guy is Green Lantern. Now everybody's Green Lantern. But I think it was just one of those things that they overlooked by accident.
Yeah. Or those were supposed to be thought balloons.
Maybe they were supposed to be, yeah, but they did not turn out that way. And Stewart has definitely got the hang of ring slinging at this point, if he was able to do this, to do what you described as a Mission Impossible sort of moment. That's exactly what this is. And this, to me, is John Stewart coming into his own. And I'm looking forward to seeing where he's going to go next with this, because he still needs to gain some more experience, but he's got the ideas down. And finally, for page 17, the last page of the issue, again, I like how Hal sort of shouldn't feel so upset, since he's the one who gave up the ring, but he is, which is very human and completely in character. We talked about this with the first issue in episode 2, where... You know, he shouldn't be that upset that Carol might be seeing another guy, but he is, and that's very human, and that's cool. And frankly, Carol should be apologizing. Just saying.
She kind of ran this ship into the ground.
Yes, she did. No, she should be apologizing for making Hal give up the ring, because he's clearly not happy that he doesn't have it and that somebody else does. He's now jealous of John Stewart. He's the one who had all the expertise and all the experience that he would have been able to handle this probably much more tidily than John Stewart did. But instead, he doesn't have the ring. He's essentially helpless. He doesn't have the superpower. He's given it up.
But Carol Ferris is happy, so that's all that matters.
Yeah, he's going to get some tonight.
As for me, they seem to be drumming up a lot of conflict between John and Hal on the covers. But truthfully, we haven't really seen that in the books outside of Hal's whining, for lack of a better word. Pages 1 and 2, I can't help but wonder if Major Disaster here wasn't Len Wein trying to cut some criticism off at the pass. Because having Hal give up the ring can't have been a decision that was, from an editorial standpoint, it couldn't have been a decision that was made lightly, even if sales were slumping. I mean, comics have changed quite a bit in the last three decades, but if I've learned anything from reading letters pages in these comics, it's that comic book fans are largely the same. And I guess we might get a better idea as we keep going through books here, but there was bound to be a section of readership that objected greatly to taking a much-loved character and replacing him with someone else.
Well, it's not like there are people that would make petitions or anything like that.
No.
No, but I mean, it's one of those things. We do still see it today with the New 52.
Yeah.
But the problem with the New 52 is that that is very much a permanent change. Because, you know, you get something like the death of Superman, or how Michael Bailey described once that when he was younger and he read Superman Exile, that he thought that that was the permanent thing. Superman was going off into space and he wasn't coming back. And so these people don't believe that there's necessarily going to be a return to the status quo, even though they just had one. When Len Wein came on as the writer, it was a return to the status quo in a lot of ways.
Right.
And we're in the middle of a big story arc right now. And right now, Jon Stewart's going to be Green Lantern. I mean, in a lot of ways, again, you could run parallels to the death and return of Superman. Of course, there's going to be a return to the status quo. It's only a question of how long and what the story is going to be like as they get there.
Right.
And I'm hoping that the rest of the stories are as good as this one, or as these three, basically.
A lot of them are. I'll be honest with you. I've read ahead. A lot of them, we're going to go through a lot of changes, and we're going to have a lot of neat conflicts within the core.
That sounds awesome. I'm really looking forward to it. That's why I wanted to be a part of this podcast, because as we were talking about before we were recording, none of us are necessarily Green Lantern experts. We're just people who really wanted to take a look at these stories, and we're looking at them really closely and as objectively as we can, but also subjectively by the mere fact that we've not read through this entire era before. There are some issues coming up that I have read before, but completely out of context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and having them in context can completely change your viewpoint.
Exactly.
Yeah. But again, on page two, we have more coloring issues. Maybe it's just a copy I have, but John's constructs are yellow here on page two, which, yeah.
Kind of
defeats
the purpose.
But that's common. That happens all the time, though. We've seen that happen in earlier issues, and we saw that definitely happen in the Silver Age issues that we covered.
Okay. I just didn't notice it then. Page five and six, we talked about Tom and how it's... His reaction here is just totally nonsense. But skipping ahead to pages 9 through 11, I really did like this scene with John stopping the flood. We haven't really seen Hal take on a threat like that so far, and John's solution was right up his alley with him being an architect and all, and having the knowledge of engineering that goes along with that.
It's really funny that they didn't mention that specifically. I mean, they did show him doing it, but they didn't mention or have him have any thought balloons. Like, it's a good thing that I've designed something like this before or seen designs like this before, because that means I can create them, which actually I think would have added some really nice color to the story.
Plus, it shows that using the ring isn't easy. Sometimes that gets overlooked when you've got a character that's worn the ring for a while, but John really struggles here, as Jeffrey kind of went over. Page 12, I know that time works differently in comics. It just has to, given that they come out monthly and you have to move the story forward. But Clay is being released from the hospital basically a week after he had his back broken. And I've never known anyone with a broken back, but I think your hospital stay would be a little longer than a week.
Depends on the severity.
Okay.
If his organs, if he was stable, which it appears he is, no, he was in bad shape. Maybe you're right. I know you can leave in certain instances. You'd have home health nurses, things like that. But yeah, he was at death's door a week ago. Never mind.
And it's probably been closer to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, I'm only saying that because definitely a few days have passed, and there was at least a week between the first and the second issue that we're talking about this episode. Because what's his name? I think Bruce Gordon mentions that something happened a week ago.
He said that in this issue?
No, it was in the previous issue. Bruce Gordon, the issue where the reflection of Eclipso is in the window. He mentions that Clay was in, or that something had happened a week ago.
And so he says Block was murdered earlier this week.
Yes. Oh, okay.
So, and that happened just a couple days after Hal got back from the Guardians.
Okay.
So we're talking maybe a week and a half.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, I mean, it's even then, even if it's been 2 weeks, that it's a broken back, hello.
Right. Pages 13 through 16, like Jeffrey said, this is John coming into his own. But it's just his trap here just cracked me up. I really don't have anything else to say about it. It was kind of silly and maybe a little implausible, but it was pretty creative and really showed John, like Jeffrey said, coming into his own. But that's all I had. I enjoyed this issue. I thought it was stronger than 182, and it was a solid initial outing for John. Just based on these two issues, he seems different enough from Hal to make things interesting, but not so different that it's going to be feel hugely foreign.
Yeah, it's not a culture shock.
Right.
And you guys kind of hit all the points that were in my notes, so...
Sorry.
No, that's okay. As long as they get hit, I'm happy. So next up is Eye Lantern Part 2, which was written by Joey Cavallari, with art by Kevin O'Neill, letters by John Costanza, colors by Anthony Tolan, who doesn't apparently know the difference between yellow and green, and edited by Lynn Wein. That was kind of mean on Anthony Tolan. I do apologize for that. both of these backup stories were actually reprinted in Green Lantern In Brightest Day trade paperback and Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Volume 2 trade paperback. And the story picks up with basically the Guardians calling Yron on his braggadocio, saying, well, you failed. We gave you the chance, so return the ring. And Yron says that, well, I haven't failed yet. So he actually takes the fight to the Kratos outpost itself on his planet, walks in disguised in a cloak, and then basically makes his way into it, starts just tearing things up old school. The Guardians remind Yron that Stell would never endanger the lives of his people by bringing this war home. And as they talk, one of the Kratos uses a corrosive agent, one that they actually plan to put in bombs and drop on the people. And Yron is critically damaged. So Yron manages to crawl to Stell's grave, realizing that Stell is the hero the planet needs, but not the one they deserve. No, he realizes that Stell is the savior that the planet needs. And in his last act, Yron is able to give his life force and resurrect Stell, who once again becomes Green Lantern of Grinda. And Stell just goes out and wipes the floor with the Kratos, or Kratos, I'm not sure which one it is. And in the end, he changes his old tomb to Yron's tomb and explains to the people that Yron gave his all to restore life to the person that could save their people once he realized that he was not able to defeat their enemies. And in his last act of sacrifice, Yron became the people's savior. The end.
So did we ever see Black Lantern Yron?
No.
Jumping ahead 50 or 30 years, did he show up?
I don't remember him if he did.
That would actually be pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Stell is still around in current times. In fact, I got a couple of action figures that came with parts of a Stell figure that you could put together.
Cool.
So I have a lower abdomen, not the chest. Chest came with a different part. I have the lower abdomen, the head, and one of the legs.
Hmm. Actually, this wasn't actually his first appearance.
No, it was not.
It was back in Green Lantern number 11, which I didn't realize.
He was in the movie too, was he not?
Yes, and they had a movie action figure of him as well.
But he looks different now, and he looked different in the movie than he did in the story.
And the movie figure was a lot smaller than the one that you could put together. It was a lot slimmer and... Not as good, but that was kind of the case with a lot of the movie figures. However, there were a couple of exclusive movie figures that were of characters that were never seen before in the Green Lantern Corps that were just kind of in the background of the film. Hmm. And so if you're really a completist of Green Lantern, you need to pick those up. But beyond that...
The movie figures are more the size of like the G.I. Joe, 3 3/4 inch G.I. Joe figures.
Yeah, the DC Universe Infinite Heroes size.
Yeah.
The ones that we had at the shop where I worked until last month were not quite the same. They were at least 6 inches tall.
They had a couple of different lines. They had a Movie Masters line that had the larger, more detailed, more accurate version.
I think that's what we had. However, with the Green Lantern film, I think that my then boss figured that Green Lantern stuff would sell well, and we had a lot of Green Lantern figures. Yeah. From the comics runs, and I did pick up a few of them, but yeah, by Christmas they were 25% off, and I'm guessing that as time goes on, they'll be out on the half price table before too long.
He was counting on that movie really making bank, and well, it didn't.
I liked it.
I thought it was. I didn't hate it. There wasn't enough for me to get mad at the movie, but I just walked out really just shrugging.
I was really glad that I saw the digital and 3D version because with that movie, it's actually worth it to do that.
I haven't seen it, so I'm gonna have to go see it now so I can be the deciding vote.
There you go.
I've got it on Blu-ray.
Bring it over.
Okay, yeah, I'll stop over later on.
You're dropping by later. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll hang out. On page 4 of this story, the part where he gives his life for Stell to come back, this is the only part of the story that I really like. Because, again, it is based on a very flawed premise, and he refused to give the ring back. No, the Guardians can take the ring back.
And then he opens the Matrix of Leadership and... Oh, sorry.
You have
right,
touch.
But actually, that's very fitting, come to think of it, because these are sentient robots. But when Stell comes back, this is the coolest part of the whole story, and it almost makes the whole thing worthwhile. And I really hope that we see some more of Stell coming up just to try and do something with this story. I hope there's no mention of the story or Wyron pretty much ever again. But the fact that Stell is back and that they can attribute it to this story, I think that's pretty cool. And again, I still don't buy into the premise that the Guardians would give this jerk a ring to begin with. But anyway, the only other thing that I have, I actually would like to save for the end because I don't think I'm guessing that neither of you quite got it.
I kind of feel bad that I don't have too much more to say about this because I did really like it. I thought it was a much better two-parter than the one we had last episode with the whatever they were. I've already forgotten.
Green Magic.
Green Magic. There you go. For some reason, these backups...
It's kind of magic.
For some reason, these backups are just difficult to have a lot of commentary on. I don't really know why that is, but I thought it was solid and well-written, even though I do agree now with Jeffrey about it being based on a flawed premise, and they probably should have made Wyron the Green Lantern from the start.
I converted you.
The art is great. Unfortunately, the printing of comic books at this time just didn't do it justice. O'Neill has a lot of fine lines that get lost and muddier colors, and of course the paper stock. But that's not his fault. I haven't seen him, but it probably looks a whole lot better in the trade paperbacks where it was reprinted. David?
Yeah, I don't have that much to say. Once again, I think the fact that Wyron gets basically killed because the Guardians are distracting him is kind of tragic because he really was tearing things up and they're playing a little morality thing and suddenly he's got a corrosive liquid.
Am I the only one who's having a hard time hearing David?
Yeah, you're cutting out.
Am I cutting out?
Yeah.
Hold on. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I just kind of played with the connection. It just took it a second. I have to...
There we
I
go.
I think it was the Wi-Fi being turned off on the iPad.
American components, Russian components, all made in Taiwan.
Yes, an Armageddon reference. Now I lost my train of thought. No, I will say it is better than Green Magic, and the art definitely it's not Gibbons art clearly. I don't want to put it on Gibbons level, but it's definitely like a sharper, more gritty version of what we've seen previously, if I can get my words out of my mouth. And it just the story just kind of left me flat. I never got into it, and it kept making me think of Transformers the movie. I just couldn't get that out of my head. So,
and so you've got that song in your head still,
The Touch. Oh yeah,
oh yeah,
yeah. But Jeffrey, you had one final note.
I do, and it's about the quote at the end, which I'm actually a big fan of. It's almost too bad that it had to be in this particular story because I didn't care for it. But it's a Latin quote, and it's De mortuis nil nisi bonum. And here's the thing about that. It sort of directly translates. It doesn't directly translate well. That's part of it. But it's basically a Latin phrase that indicates that it's socially inappropriate to say anything negative about a specifically recently deceased person. And it's sometimes shortened to nil nisi bonum, which is the phrase that derives from the sentence. So the full version, if you wanted to translate it directly, would be De mortuis nil nisi bonum dicendum est. And it's sort of translated to speak no ill of the dead.
Right.
Or of the dead speak no evil.
That actually kind of impresses me. That kind of changes my opinion a little bit, I'll be honest with you.
And it's a great quote to have, and it's if you don't know your Latin or can't at least like kind of figure out the Latin from it, because de mortuis means of the dead, nil nisi bonum is basically never speak other than good, because bonum is like bonus, it means good, and nil is never or nothing. Actually, it's really kind of nothing, like nil. There you go.
Well, it fits the end of the story.
Absolutely.
Is that all we had on this? Comment-wise on this one?
All we had on this one, and that kind of wraps up the episode. So what are we going to be taking a look at in the next one?
Well, we will have... I was going to do the other appearances real quick.
Okay.
There was only two other very minor appearances of Green Lantern elsewhere. First, in Justice League of America number 231, it was just a one-panel cameo from Hal. And then Hal also appears on the cover of Justice League of America Annual number 2. He's on the cover, but not in the story, because that is the beginning of the Justice League Detroit era.
Yeah. That's a great era. Yeah, Vibe. And Gypsy.
Vibe Rebirth. For anybody who doesn't know, there was an April Fool's joke on the Fortress of Bailey 2 that Michael Bailey was having with
Shag.
With Shag, thank you. And it was about, since Green Lantern Rebirth had come out and Flash Rebirth had come out, that the new one would be Vibe Rebirth.
Jeff Jones, Ethan Van Sciver.
Oh, yeah.
But next episode, we'll be actually looking at four issues. Green Lantern 184, 185, and 186, which are the final issues from Ween and Gibbons. Plus, we'll have a look at Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Annual, number 1.
It's going to be a great episode.
It's going to be a big one.
I really enjoyed these books. These were some of the best books. It's continually improving so far.
Yes, we're on an uphill climb, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah, because it was one of those things, as we were getting into it, I was like, man, I mean, I recognize that this was a really great era of Green Lantern, and that's what I've always been told, but it's taking a while to get there because I just wasn't digging on a lot of those issues.
Yeah, Rome wasn't built in a day, so...
Gotcha. But, I mean, these three issues that we talked about today are definitely a high point for me, at least so far. I hope that it continues to be higher and higher points.
Well, with who debuts next episode, I think we can count on that.
Is it Nort?
It does start with a G. So I guess until next time.
I took a sense, so somebody else take us out.
Okay.
Until next time, this is Michael Bradley.
I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I'm J. David Taylor Weeder.
What?
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
I'm J. David Weeder.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weeder. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then...
In brightest day.
In blackest night.
No evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might...
Beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.
You sound like Cher with the voice warbler thing.
Do you believe?
That's exactly what you sound like.
Yeah. Let me turn the Wi-Fi off on the iTunes.
That's going in the outtakes.
Yeah.